Welcome to the Science Podcast for July 18th, 2014. I'm Sarah Crespi. In this week's show, we talk about a technology that may be able to alter the genes of wild populations of animals. And David Grimm is here with a roundup of daily news stories.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
The ability to precisely target and eliminate agricultural pests, disease-carrying animals, or even invasive species has long been on the scientific horizon. Tools like pesticides, insecticides, and animal birth control have been the order of the day. But what if you could introduce a gene into these organisms that was almost guaranteed to be passed on to its offspring, and this introduced gene then slowed the reproductive activity of the population? What are the potential downsides of such a technology? I spoke with Kenneth Oya about how this intervention might work and the concerns that come along with it.
For decades, scientists have dreamed of using a technology called gene drives to alter populations in the wild, to eradicate mosquitoes or eliminate their ability to carry malaria, all kinds of good stuff. That dream may actually now become a reality. Biological engineers are using Cas9 and CRISPR, two new technologies, to do what they've thought about for years. So the good news is that exciting things may be coming. But at the same time, these gene drives have the potential to create environmental and security challenges. Our piece in Science is intended to describe the technological developments, to evaluate the risks, and to talk about potential gaps in governing structures.
Can you tell us a bit about the basic biology behind a gene drive?
Okay. During normal sexual reproduction, there are two versions of a given gene in each of the parents, and there's a 50% chance of inheritance. Gene drives are genetic systems that circumvent these rules. They increase the odds that a drive will be passed on to offspring. And this allows them to spread to all members of the population, even if they reduce the chance that an individual organism will reproduce. So this does take place in nature. The gene drives that we're talking about here are designed or engineered to spread specific genetic elements through targeted populations over generations. And the biological engineering is challenging. At the same time, if applied, what they would do is spread gradually through targeted wild populations and do represent a potentially powerful tool for management of ecosystems.
Is this being tested in any field sites or in the lab? What's the status of the research?
So no one has actually built a gene drive and applied it to wild populations. In our view, that's actually good. Scientists have successfully built engineered gene drives that spread through laboratory populations of mosquitoes and fruit flies. And these have been done using kind of earlier technologies. The new gene drives that are under discussion in the Science piece, again, have not been developed and tested. In fact, what we've been trying to do is to have a discussion early on, before development and testing, because of their potential implications for shared ecosystems.
Can you give a couple examples of how these might be used? I think you mentioned malaria as one example. What else might be a good place to try out this kind of technology?
There are a number of exciting potential areas for application, and I want to emphasize the word potential because this hasn't been done. We've talked a little bit about potentially eradicating the potential for mosquitoes to carry malaria. Eradication of invasive species is also a possibility by altering their reproduction rates. And the third area would be even by reducing herbicide resistance or pesticide resistance. One last note that I think is truly exciting. We have been concerned and are rightly concerned over the possibility of introduction of unwanted genetic elements by accident in the wild populations. Concern over release has been around for a long time. There is the potential for gene drives to reverse the unwanted introduction of genetic elements by targeting those elements and reprogramming to restore the original sequences.
And if this method were deployed to control populations in this way or in some other way, what are some of the concerns that it might raise?
We're still learning about how ecosystems work. We've done initial assessments that we provide in summary in the piece in Science. But to be clear, the point here is that anyone and everyone could miss things that are important. A gene drive that alters the characteristics of an entire population could cause unexpected and potentially harmful side effects on other organisms and species. We understand that the risks will primarily depend on the proposed alterations in the species rather than on the fact that you're using a gene drive, but that doesn't reduce the need to understand and to study and to investigate thoroughly what those effects might be before you go out there and release them into wild populations.
There were some interesting ideas in the paper about how to put fail-safes into this, for example, making them reversible or only time-limited.
Our piece in Science goes over a number of possible safety mechanisms and safety measures that should be in place as you work through and talk about applications in wild populations. Our first point is that you don't want to start with wild populations. You obviously want to be doing a lot of lab work, and you want to be doing work in controlled settings. But as you move towards potential for field release, we would like to see having in place reversible drives and callback options before doing field release.
How exactly might recall work?
Your primary gene drive, you release a gene drive and it edits sequences in wild populations. The reversal drives are drives that are intended to target the edited sequence and restore them, then you're changing them potentially back to the original code. The potential for reversal is exciting, but it doesn't necessarily undo all the population effects, the epigenetics. Life is complicated.
This reminds me a little bit of geoengineering. I think there was an example of someone just dumping a bunch of iron into the ocean to try out and see what would happen. Do you think that something like that could happen with a gene drive?
The answer is that one of my greatest concerns or fears here is that you have the potential for unilateral use.
Mm-hmm.
So you take geoengineering, which was the example that you were talking about, the iron filings, or solar irradiative management, the mm-hmm. idea of putting a lot of particles up there. And you have, in those technologies, fairly inexpensive options that potentially have global implications and effects. Well, gene drives are kind of like that. You could have potentially individual laboratories developing gene drives and not necessarily behaving as responsibly. And they could decide that they want to take back an invasive species. Or if you're a country with malaria, you might well want to do that experiment, eliminating the capacity of mosquitoes to carry malaria. Well, guess what? You don't necessarily limit the effects to one jurisdiction or one locality.
Mm-hmm.
It could spread.
Or even one type of mosquito.
Exactly. Well, with one type of mosquito, you could actually design or target the gene drives to be much more specific. I mean, that's one of the beauties of this in terms of being able to try to limit effect to a targeted sequence.
Right.
But, and here's the but, you never know.
Right, I know.
The drives could evolve, they could change. You know, we're not talking about a piece of rock. You're talking about living things that do have the capacity for evolving, and you have the potential for lateral gene transfer. So you're never quite sure that it's going to work exactly as you want. And even if they do, what governing structures do we have mm-hmm. for making sure that use is responsible when individuals or groups could potentially do this without consultation with others? So, you know, there are a lot of huge issues here. Your example of the iron filings or release of particles into the atmosphere is spot on. Again, people are trying to be benevolent when they're doing that. It's not even malicious. But the side effects are serious enough, so you want to be going after those side effects, and you want a broader public dialogue on appropriate use. The benefits and the risks have to be evaluated, and it's not a call to be made just by one little lab group.
Mm-hmm.
One reason why we did this piece in Science was to try to spur that broader discussion and to get it going before these things are kind of developed and field tested.
Ken, thanks so much for talking with me.
It's a great pleasure. Take care now.
Kenneth Oya and colleagues write about gene drives in a Science Express policy forum this week. You can read the whole article at www.scienceexpress.org. Now we have David Grimm, the editor for our daily news site. He's here to talk about some recent online stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on denser diamonds. Diamonds are the least compressible material in the world, meaning that making them denser using pressure is incredibly difficult. But researchers using an extremely high-tech facility in California have done just that. Let's start with the facility, Dave. What is its actual function?
This is the National Ignition Facility. It's located in Livermore, California. It's a pretty impressive piece of equipment. It spans 10 meters. It's armed with scores of lasers. And it's so visually impressive that it was actually used, little trivia fact here, as the warp core of the Starship Enterprise in the 2013 movie Star Trek Into Darkness. But it has a more practical purpose as well. Researchers use it for some basic science. They investigate how various materials respond when compressed. It's also been used to trigger nuclear fusion, which is the same type of reaction that powers the sun, as a way to hopefully someday solve our energy needs.
So in this case, they focused all this pressure onto a diamond. What happened to the diamond? Did it turn into a very small diamond?
They trained 176 lasers on the diamond. And what they found is that they were able to actually squeeze this diamond to compress it so much that it reached a pressure of 50 million atmospheres. And that's 14 times greater than the pressure at Earth's center.
And so the diamond's structure changed?
The diamond turned to dust.
Okay.
But right before it did, it became very dense. It actually became denser than lead and 12 times as dense as water. A normal diamond is only about 3 times as dense as water.
So the point of putting all this pressure on these precious stones is because it can tell us about other planets. How does that work?
Well, that's definitely one application of this research. A lot of planets actually have very intense internal pressures, even much more intense than Earth's. For example, Jupiter's core has a pressure of between 40 and 90 million atmospheres. And so you're talking about a diamond that reached a pressure of 50 million atmospheres. You're starting to get a sense of what might be going on in the center of these planets. There's actually some worlds out there that have been proposed to be composed of diamond. So this particular research may provide even more accurate information about what's going on in the center of these planets.
Next up, we have a story on sexual harassment. Gender in science is a fraught topic. Why is the representation of women low in certain fields? Are certain fields safer for women than others? In a report this week, a survey of scientists is bringing to light sexual harassment in the field. So, Dave, this isn't the first survey of its kind. What's the backstory here?
Well, this is a group of researchers that actually a couple of years ago started surveying some colleagues in the field of biological anthropology. This was prompted by one of the authors. Her friend had actually been raped in the field, and this scientist wondered if there was more things like this going on. So they conducted a survey that was reported last year that showed that there was a high incidence of sexual harassment, at least in biological anthropology. And in this new study, the researchers wanted to survey a much broader field. They wanted to look at several fields of science, the life sciences, the physical sciences, the social sciences, and just get a much larger pool of researchers to see if this was a much more endemic problem to all of science.
So how did they go about broadening out their survey? Where did they collect the data?
They got a lot of information from the internet. They pinged people on email, on social networks, online groups where scientists tend to hang out. And at the end of the day, they received 666 responses that represented researchers from about 30 nations, 32 different scientific disciplines.
Looking across this new, larger sample, did they see any trends?
What they did see was definitely that across all these samples, they saw a disturbing amount of sexual harassment. This includes things like comments, sexually charged comments, to inappropriate touching, to even things like rape. And what they found was that about 64% of the survey respondents reported that they had been personally sexually harassed. A vast majority of these were women, although there were some men that also reported harassment. And also a vast majority were younger researchers, which you might expect because these are the type of researchers that are more likely to be taken advantage of by potentially a project leader or somebody who has a position of authority in a research group.
Is there any sense that the subjects might be self-selecting into the survey?
Well, that's one concern. When you put out a survey like this, the concern is that the people that have been harassed are going to be much more likely to respond to the survey, and therefore you're going to get a biased sample.
Is this the kind of numbers that we're seeing here comparable to what has been found in other workplaces?
It seems to be. There had been another survey that was done on medical trainees, and that found that 22% of males and 73% of females had also experienced workplace sexual harassment. So this doesn't seem to be a problem that's just confined to the scientific community.
Lastly, we have a story on the link between pleasure and pot. Marijuana is gaining status in this country and others, becoming legal in Colorado and Uruguay. But scientists still don't know everything about how it works and what its effects are on the brain. Why has studying this been so difficult?
Well, marijuana is actually a pretty complicated substance chemically. There's a lot going on, plus you have a lot of different strains, so it's hard to tell if different strains impact people differently. And there's just been not a lot of research done on it because, as you mentioned, Sarah, it hasn't been legal in some places until recently, which has made it very hard to conduct these studies.
This study looked at some unexpected side effects in the brain of people who use marijuana regularly. What exactly were they looking at?
Well, they looked at very heavy users of marijuana. These are people that smoked an average of 5 joints a day, 5 days a week for 10 years. And the researchers were particularly looking at a chemical called dopamine in the brain, which is the main ingredient in the brain's reward system. It's the chemical that tells you after you do something pleasurable, like, hey, that was great, let's do it again. Other research on drugs like cocaine and alcohol has shown that people that abuse these drugs have less dopamine in their brains, so their reward center is damaged, and that might cause them to abuse these drugs to get that reward back.
And so when they took a close look at the brains of these heavy pot users, how did they stack up against people who abstain?
Well, what the researchers did is actually gave these heavy pot users the drug Ritalin, which should stimulate the amount of dopamine in the brain. And what they found was that compared to controls, the heavy pot users actually had about the same amount of dopamine, but they didn't seem to be responding to that dopamine as well. So, for example, the controls had increased heart rates and increased blood pressure, and they reported feeling restless and high. The marijuana abusers didn't, which suggested that somehow their brains didn't seem to be responding to the dopamine.
Is it possible to tell causality in this situation? Might these people do this drug because of low dopamine levels?
And that's a great question. That's something that this study doesn't answer. It's also possible that the brains of marijuana users just respond differently to Ritalin than those of the controls, which could also be a confounding factor here. And then there's the issue of how many people actually smoke pot this hardcore, smoking 5 joints a day, 5 days a week for 10 years. One of my colleagues who will go unnamed says he lives in the pot capital of the world and he doesn't know anybody that smokes that much. So that could have also potentially biased the results. And if you want to hear a little bit more about this, we've actually got a Q&A with a researcher who keeps an eye on marijuana research and some of his thoughts about studies like this and what they tell us and also how politics plays into them.
Okay, so what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, we've got a story about how ancient viruses are still showing up in human DNA. Also a story about scientists trying to decode bird songs using computer algorithms. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about 2 new proposed dark matter experiments in the U.S. Also a story about whether labs should be creating dangerous pathogens in order to study them. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, sir.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org or tweet to us at Science Magazine. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and many other places, or listen on the Science site. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.